Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. I'm Brad Stone of the New York Times. Tonight we take a closer look at the business of crowdsourcing, understanding the true value of people power in the business world. Crowdsourcing is an idea that's been almost constantly in vogue here in Silicon Valley over the last 5 or so years. It's the idea of tapping into the power of people spread around the world via the internet. And the idea has generated both innovation and controversy. From building a people-powered online encyclopedia to algorithm contests, crowdsourcing might be the world's largest real-time workforce. But questions remain. Can you trust the crowd to give high-quality information? Will the movement allow a whole new way to work for the disenfranchised? How will being able to share knowledge more efficiently than ever before change the world? And perhaps most importantly, when will my job be crowdsourced? Tonight we have assembled an impressive panel of experts. Lucas Biewald is the founder and CEO of Crowdflower, which specializes in making Amazon's Mechanical Turk service, among others, more reliable. Previously, he was the senior scientist and manager of the ranking and metrics team at PowerSet, where he built an Amazon Mechanical Turk interface. Lila Jana is the founder and CEO of SamaSource. She is the recipient of the Rainier Arnold and TED India Fellowships and serves on the San Francisco board of the Social Enterprise Institute. She's also a former visiting scholar at the Stanford Program on Global Justice. Jason Aiken is the business development and marketing manager for 99designs, connecting more than 60,000 passionate designers from around the globe with small businesses who need design projects. And previously, Jason was part of the senior management team at Vantage Communications. Lily Arani is a PhD candidate in informatics with a graduate feminist emphasis. Her dissertation work looks at new transnational design collaborations between India and the U.S. She currently studies in the Laboratory for Ubiquitous Computing and Interaction at the University of California at Irvine and is the co-creator of the Turkopticon Worker Rights Project. And finally, Patrick McKenna is the founder and CEO of Kennex, and he is also the founder and former vice president of Live Ops. He is a term member of the Council on Foreign Relations, serves on the board of Rapleaf, and the Hands on Bay Area board. And Patrick is also an active angel investor. Well, I think probably to the uninitiated in that introduction, I threw out some terminology that everyone may not be familiar with. So, Lucas, let's just start with you and help us define these terms. What is crowdsourcing? And I mentioned Amazon's Mechanical Turk service. It really started to generate discussion about this back in 2005. You know, what is Mechanical Turk and what does crowdsourcing mean?
Sure. So crowdsourcing is a fairly amorphous term, and it's hard to believe for how much usage it gets that I think Jeff Howe actually coined it in 2007.
He's a Wired writer.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's exploded in popularity. It clearly defined a phenomenon that exists. But when he defined it, he was really talking about things like Wikipedia or Yahoo Answers, where you have businesses essentially or business value being created by lots and lots of volunteers working together. And since then, we've seen companies really harnessing this, right? So we've seen, for example, Netflix, which took its core reputation technology, which is really core to its business, and they said, we'll give a $1 million prize to anyone that can give a 10% improvement. And they let anyone around the world access a huge chunk of its data and then build a better reputation algorithm, which they then submitted and then generated a better algorithm. I think the phenomenon of crowdsourcing predates the name crowdsourcing by quite a bit. And I think where it started was the internet making it really easy to connect people that needed certain kinds of things done with people that were willing to do that kind of work. So I think you see lots of simple tasks, simple valuable tasks being done since the beginning of the internet, right? So you see companies like Gerson Lerman, which I'm not sure people would necessarily think of as crowdsourcing, but this is a company where if you're a hedge fund and you have a really specific question about a company you want to invest in, some really technical thing about microbiology or something, you can pay an expert $1,000 to give you a really detailed answer on that. And Gerson Lerman keeps track of lots and lots of experts around the world, and will connect you simply with that person. So that's a sort of type of crowdsourcing. On the total other end of the spectrum, you have a website called Amazon Mechanical Turk, which is this amazing phenomenon where you can post a task, a really simple task typically, a task that might take someone 5 minutes, and you can immediately get someone to do this for you, right? So there's actually an artist, Aaron Koblin, who wanted to get 20,000 sheep drawings. And so he paid 2 cents for someone to draw him a left-facing sheep. And he was able to get 20,000 people on the internet each to draw him a sheep. And that might seem ridiculous, right? That might seem like it doesn't have real business value, but you can imagine another simple task that might really have value. So, for example, a social network wants to check if it's the pictures being uploaded are offensive or not, right? So instead of relying on their community or instead of hiring a bunch of people to sit in a room and look at each picture, they post the pictures one at a time, and anonymous people on the internet show up and say, okay, this fits your criteria or this picture doesn't fit your criteria.
So they're basically looking for pornographic images.
Well, or maybe copyright.
Which, by the way, sounds like a great job. I wish I knew about that when I was a teenager.
And I think, but that really illustrates, right? I mean, some people might find that job fun, right? I mean, some people might actually enjoy that job. And so finding those people that actually want to do that task and paying them a little bit of money might add a huge amount of value to your business. But before the internet, it would be really difficult to find someone, sit them down for 10 minutes and get them to work for you, and then fire them after those 10 minutes. But with technology, you can actually find them, pay them the tiny amount of money, and then get rid of them when you don't need them anymore.
So, Patrick, you're actually crowdsourcing sort of actual phone calls, right? Tell us a little bit about live ops and really what the limit is of this kind of work. How far can you go in really outsourcing work to the crowd?
So LiveOps is a very specific application of the crowd, and the problem that we attacked was call center. Very famous problem. You'd be surprised. There are 3, sometimes depending on seasonality, 4 million call center workers in the United States. It's a big industry, and there's been a lot of news about it moving offshore and kind of going global. Our approach was to apply technology. So we built a technology platform that would route calls to anybody's computer anywhere. And we allowed people working from home with their home computer to log in just using a regular browser, no download, and become a call center agent from their home. And with that application, they were able to set their own schedule, sign up for what kind of work they wanted to do, and be in control of their work. And now what we did with this is the application being call center, we went out and found people who were looking for call center when US agents, and they didn't really care if they were working at home or not. All right, and so now we found companies that were doing insurance sales and catalog and all sorts of stuff across the spectrum, and they didn't really mind what the call was, but they were looking for higher quality, lower cost. We turned to the crowd and applied and said, we have a job doing this in these times. People signed up, set their own schedule, and depending on how many people showed up for the work, it would determine how much they were going to get paid per hour. So, I mean, another interesting thing about the call center was there are a lot of pieces of the work. There's just not just answering the phone, but there's quality. How are you going to monitor quality? How are you going to take things that are voice recording so you get transcription? So we kind of think about the transactional pieces of the entire call center process and break it down into little components and find the best worker for that work. Some agents are really good at taking pizza orders. Some agents are really good at taking infomercial inbound. And some agents are skilled with licensed insurance licenses and can take licensed agent calls. So we kind of took the entire call center ecosystem, broke it down into little pieces, and found the best person for each one of those components of the job.
Have you ever had an agent just greet a customer on the phone with a barrage of profanity?
One thing with the technology is you can 100% record everything, and the agents know that they're being recorded, mm-hmm. and quality obviously is a big part, and that would probably be a short part of their job. One thing that's interesting about it's not so easy to get a job like being a live ops call center agent. There's a lot of stuff you have to invest. You get a background check. You have to take a written test. You do a voice recording to see how well you speak. We do Spanish and English, so if you're a good Spanish speaker, you're a good English speaker. By the time somebody has invested that much of their time into getting the job, it's highly valuable. We also use a bit of a game theory where people get the data. They know what quality is. Is it a short call? Is it a first call resolution? Is it a higher close rate? Is it an average order? And they have a little dashboard that says, this is how you're doing against other people doing the same job. And it breaks down into the little components. So if they want to improve their performance, they have true visibility. And the better they do, the more calls they get, the more work they have, the more stable the job is for them. And if they do throw profanity out on the phone, well, they have a, you know, have a little problem.
Jason Aiken, tell us a little bit about 99designs and what you guys have learned about who you can get into these sort of crowdsourcing platforms and whether they can really make it, you know, into a living.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, so 99designs is a crowdsourced graphic design marketplace. And so we've got about 60,000 active graphic designers who participate in open design projects. So if you're a small business and you need something designed, a logo, marketing materials, you name it, any static graphic image, trying to find that designer has often been a big challenge, right? There's a lot of risk involved. At the end of the day, you don't know where to start. You might not know anybody. And you've got to figure out, who am I going to go with? Who am I going to trust? And at the end of the day, are they going to produce something that I like? So with 99designs, you tap into the crowd of designers who basically design. You describe what you want, and then they design it. You review it in real time, give them feedback. They change it. So you can see the designs up front. So there's a lot of interest on both sides of the equation. It takes a lot of risk out for the small business and provides a lot of opportunity on the designer side. Like I said, we've got about 60,000 graphic designers all over the world. About, I think, between 30 and 40% are in the U.S., but big hotspots in India, Philippines, Indonesia, Romania, you name it, anywhere. And it is definitely an attractive opportunity. I mean, I think our top logo designer makes many times the average annual salary. You know, for Romania, he's a Romanian guy. He's a machine. He just cranks these projects out. I think he's won maybe 400 or 500 logo projects. And this guy, I mean, he makes more money than I do. So he's doing quite well. That's not the only story. I mean, you've got disabled designers who, you know, this woman, she, had a family, got tied up doing that. She wasn't able to then to go out and go to client meetings and get work that way. And 99designs allowed her to get work because you didn't have to go out looking for it. It was all pooled together. So she's now been able to sort of realize her dream in doing design. You name it. I mean, it's
how many of your designers are overseas?
Well, between, I would say, 60 to 65%, depending.
So, Leela Chana, you've done some fantastic work at SamaSource. Tell us a little bit about the program, and I understand that the program's active in 9 countries, including some refugee camps.
Yeah. So SamaSource is a Bay Area-based nonprofit, and we connect around 600 women, youth, and refugees living in poverty in 9 different countries in Africa, Asia, and now Haiti to digital work opportunities via the Internet. So we were founded on the premise that what poor people need most is access to dignified work and income. And very few nonprofit organizations and aid agencies are focused on this kind of job creation in this new emerging world of crowdsourcing and in the larger world of outsourcing, which is a $200 billion global industry, only 1% of which gets spent in high-poverty regions. So we thought there's a huge opportunity here to take this growing pool of educated people. There's now literacy rates have reached, I think, around 85% globally. So we're seeing a surge in human capacity and a surge in access to technology and not a similar surge in access to dignified work. So we thought there was a great opportunity to connect this incredible market demand we're seeing in the U.S. with labor. And so our model works sort of like a distributed outsourcing company. We identify what we call service partners, which are generally nonprofit organizations or social enterprises in these high poverty regions that have access to computing infrastructure. So they might be a university with a computer lab that wants to turn their lab into a revenue generator by night. It might look like a small little internet cafe, which you're now seeing more and more of in rural parts of India and Africa. And it might look like a grassroots or very small outsourcing company that got started with money from a microfinance institution. So we find these partners, we do a site visit, we train workers at the partner site to do very specific types of work that we identify generally here in San Francisco. So Crowdflower is actually one of our customers. We use platforms like like Crowdflower and Mechanical Turk, as well as more traditional kind of outsourcing work through bigger companies. And then once our sales team has identified these customers and vetted that, we send the work over and have it done by this distributed partner network and do some of the quality assurance and billing from here in San Francisco.
Can you just give us maybe one particular example of a project, perhaps in the third world?
Absolutely. So I'll use Crowdflower because Lucas is here. Last summer, I went to the largest refugee site in the world, which has 300,000 Somali refugees who are actively being recruited as we speak to join terrorist organizations in the Horn of Africa. There's a really interesting Wired piece, actually, that showed that the rational choice for them is to join a pirate group because they'll make far more money than they might make in the non-existent job market in Mogadishu or in this refugee camp. So we thought, you know, we heard there were computer labs there. We heard that there was some donor who put in a satellite dish and that there were 40 computers, and we thought, why not use these computers to actually create livelihoods that make it more profitable to join the formal economy than to become a pirate? And so we went over there and decided we would test the Crowdflower interface in this refugee camp. And as we speak, we have 16 refugees who are doing paid tasks on Crowdflower, who are doing stuff like, you know, address verification.
Okay, so they could be looking at the photos that we're all uploading to MySpace or Facebook and determining whether they're inappropriate or not.
We can't pipe porn into the refugee camps yet.
And they're getting paid same rates, whatever the going rate is on Amazon, Mechanical Turk, on Crowdflower.
Absolutely. I mean, we think that we can be competitive with these other workforces, but we're still trying to figure out, getting infrastructure into some of the locations that we work in, places like Dharamshala in India, where there are Tibetan refugees, or this place in Dadaab. Require slightly higher costs, so we generally will try to subsidize those costs with donor-funded infrastructure or cheap netbooks.
Lily Arani, obviously it's a time of high unemployment here in the United States, almost 10%. There a lot of people would probably be uncomfortable with the notion that, you know, at least some of the work here is being distributed out onto the internet. But you've studied the kind of the crowdsourcing ecosystem. Tell us a little bit about the Turkopticon project and what you learned.
Yeah, so I started looking into Mechanical Turk specifically about a year and a half ago because there's so much energy and excitement around crowdsourcing, but I felt that nobody was really talking about the specific situations of the workers who are coming into these systems. So I put up, my colleague Six Silberman and I put up some tasks on Mechanical Turk because it's actually really hard to find workers who are distributed all over the world, and asked people why they were, you know, doing Mechanical Turk, what were the big things that they liked about it, what were the big issues they were facing. And one of the big issues that came up over and over was that workers had very little leverage. They were treated as contractors that the employers can't see, and they were told, well, take it or leave it. The job is here. If you don't like it, you can go. So one of the things that many people reported was that they can do a task expecting to get paid for it, and then an employer could take the task, use it for whatever they wanted, but actually say that the task was poorly done and not pay. Workers' reputations are tracked in Mechanical Turk, but not employers' reputations. So my colleague Six and I thought that one really simple thing that we could do as we're learning about workers' conditions to positively intervene in the situation is make Turkopticon. So Turkopticon is something that people can install in their web browsers, and as they're browsing around Mechanical Turk, it'll actually insert a little button next to each requester's name that shows how many good and bad reviews those requesters or employers in Mechanical Turk parlance have gotten. And so that's a way to let workers navigate around employers that have not paid or treated other workers poorly in the past. But also we wanted that tool to kind of stand there and ask, you know, stand as a reminder to employers, to Amazon, to say, hey, you know, these are real people. Some of them really need the money. And you need to actually design these tools for crowdsourcing in a way that lets make sure that those workers are being treated fairly.
So with that added transparency, are you comfortable with the crowdsourcing model? Can it be, you know, a force for good around the world, a new source of employment for impoverished people?
I'm not entirely comfortable with it, but I mean, crowdsourcing takes so many different forms in different places, and there's so many different kinds of employers. We see some employers that treat workers really well and seem to really care about workers' well-being. I think the one important thing is making sure that workers are actually part of the conversation about how these crowdsourcing systems are being designed. Another important thing is not forgetting that there are real people there that actually depend on the work. While there are a lot of people in poor countries that do these tasks, there's also people in the United States who tell us that, you know, they work 60 hours a week to make $120 extra a week, and that's the difference between them living in their house or a tent at these times when it's really hard for people to pick up full-time jobs. So I think the third key question is this work that people are doing through crowdsourcing something that builds human capital? Is it something where people can build reputations and skills that they can take elsewhere and use that to get steadier employment or, you know, actually get employment that engages them in their community? Because right now, some crowdsourcing platforms like Mechanical Turk, someone might label 1,000 images and make $100 off of it, but if they do that for several months, they have a big hole in their resume. They can't take that somewhere and say, look, you know, I built this skill that now you in your office or in your, you know, hair salon might actually be able to find useful. So.
Lucas, I'll let you take the first crack at addressing this. What Lily seems to be, you know, suggesting is that there's the possibility, you know, of this sort of devolving into a big online digital sweatshop. How do we make this kind of work more rewarding, more fulfilling, and prevent that from happening?
Well, I think one thing that's happening here is the transaction costs of getting work are going down. So, I mean, if you think about our when we go to a customer and we say, you should take some critical piece of your supply chain and you should outsource it to these thousands of people that we have no relationship with, it feels like why would they ever do that? I mean, you'd wonder, like, how is the quality going to work? How can I trust these people to do a good job as opposed to these people I hire that I bring in and they sit down and work? If you think about why someone might want to do that, there's lots of transaction costs that go down. There's lots of overhead when you go out and hire someone to do a task for you that's really expensive, and that could come out of worker salaries, somebody's paying for that, right? Either the worker's paying for it or the company's paying for it. And so I think there's an opportunity here when you have a really efficient system to actually put upward pressure on worker wages. I think what you see right now, I mean, you see Mechanical Turk is actually, in some sense, the worst example of this kind of environment because it's sort of the most replaceable workers doing sort of the most menial tasks right now, right? But on the other hand, when we were bootstrapping my company, I was able to make $300 off Gerson Lerman because somebody happened to have a question about crowdsourcing, and that was actually really incredible to me because I had this knowledge and no one would ever have found me and said, okay, this person wants this. So I think there's sort of two sides to this, and I think it's still so nascent that it remains to be seen where it'll end up. And I also want to add that our workers are really powerful advocates for us in all the different worker pools that we go into. So in particular in Mechanical Turk, I don't get very many workers writing in to say, I hate you, I wish that you would go away and not post tasks. The emails that we get from workers are things like, you know, I had post-traumatic stress disorder, I couldn't hold down a real job, this is the first time that I feel like I've been able to do productive work in years, and this is, you know, beyond a job important to me. So, I'm not saying it's a good thing or a bad thing, I really don't know. Probably other people have more insightful things to say.
Patrick McKenna?
Lucas makes a great point about, you know, looking at Turk as the example of crowdsourcing. I'll look at the call center again. Recurring example. That is not considered a great job. Going into a call center and sitting in a cube and putting on a headset and just getting fed call after call after call. And that is notoriously not a great job. The machine is actually controlling you. With crowdsourcing, if the LiveOps model, and there are other companies that are using home agents for call center, it completely changes the relationship. the worker at this point now is opting into the work, sets their pace, has their pause. And there are a couple other things that I'd want to point out here. The economic model is very powerful. Where you put facility-based work, now people have to commute to that work. You have overhead, you have those costs that either come out in wages or come out in lost productivity and go up in cost. When you distribute the work and talk about the call center work, that work can go anywhere. Little towns in Georgia. Georgia's one of our biggest states. There's not a lot of other call centers there, not a lot of other work there that pays, you know, $9 an hour. You think about the economics to the individual worker are very powerful. If you're going to drive 20 miles to work, you have to have work clothes, you have to buy lunch in the office, and you have to pay for gas. And if you're driving 20 miles round trip, it's 40 miles a day, you're spending 4 gallons at $3. You know, you're spending $12, maybe $10 or $12 after-tax money to get to work for a $6 or $7 an hour job, where you can work at home, you can eat at home, you don't have to take care of paying for people watching your kids, and you don't pay for that gas. That net dollar is a lot more valuable. And the last point I'll make is, you know, the technology is allowing, you know, we talk, there was the book, you know, The World is Flat. And that was really talking about big peaks, you know, Shanghai connected to San Francisco, connected to New York. I think with crowdsourcing, it flattens it even further because it's San Francisco-based company using workers in Aiken, Georgia and, you know, small town USA, and everybody's making the same amount of money, whether they're in San Francisco or in these other areas. And we pass that savings on to our clients and kind of make a balance between having a lower price so the work stays in the U.S. and a higher wage so it's a more attractive job. And by the way, we have thousands of people applying every week at LiveOps. The door just knock, 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 because it's considered such a good job.
Lily, does any of that quell your fears?
Well, it is really hard to tell what's going to happen with this form of work, but I think one of the things we might look at is historical trends in employment. So crowdsourcing itself is fairly new, but this trend towards hiring people in more flexible ways so that you can find them, hire them for what you need them for, and then fire them without too much trouble. It's actually been going on since the 80s. And as corporations have hired, companies that have employed people flexibly in this way have tended to break apart into two groups. One group of really highly valued employees, the people who get paid $300 to answer questions, who have, you know, pretty rare skills. And then another group of people who tend to be hired around work that's been structured to be done by people with fairly replaceable skills. And so, you know, even in the mid-90s, sociologists found that about a third of jobs in the U.S. had moved to temp or part-time forms of work. And this trend of having two classes of work was broad and nationwide. This trended towards de-skilling and towards lower wages for a particular class of workers. So we can look to other industries that have been structured in this way for some hints at whether organizing crowdsourced workers, you know, in this way remotely might, where it might be empowering and where we might see problems that we can anticipate.
So are you talking about like a union for crowdsourced workers?
Well, I'm talking about looking at the millions of people in this country who have been unable to find a full-time job over the last 10 years because, you know, Walmart got into a lot of trouble for hiring people only part-time so they can avoid paying for health benefits. And we can look at the experiences that those workers have had and talk. We might talk about unions. We might talk about universal health care as a way of providing some of the support that we used to rely on corporations to provide full-time employees. If we don't have corporations providing that kind of support anymore, then maybe there's a different kind of role for the government in this changing economic landscape.
Well, to what extent is the government relevant here? I mean, can you tax a crowdsourced worker? Certainly not one who's halfway around the world. Does minimum wage apply? Does anybody want to take a crack at that? Patrick, I'm down to you.
I would only, a general comment to that is it's a very important issue. I mean, we have, 20th century labor laws and a 21st century workforce. And so I think we do need to take a really, very strong look. It's not just low-skilled workers. It's we hire a lot of temps to do IT work. Developers are, in this right around in this part of the country, we have people making $200-$300 an hour as contractors. And they really like that. They like that flexibility. to live on the beach in Thailand and code or do SEO for some company. And companies should be able to hire them and be in, you know, neutral to where that person is and the choices they want to make, because the technology is here. So I would only answer the question by saying I think we need to take a very rational look at the technology and the shape of the workforce. And, you know, for me, it's creating more freedom, more flexibility for people. It's not for a labor union or for a legislator or somebody else to decide. It's we need to have rules that allow people to have more choices. We have more choices to up their skills and use technology and move up the chain. So I don't know what the rules should be. I do know that the rules that we're kind of bringing along with us in this next century need to be really looked at, and hopefully we don't close off options for people by just, you know, by not looking at it in an open-minded way.
Leila Jana?
So I want to address a couple points that have been made. I think we're looking at two sides of a coin. You know, on the one hand, there are tremendous benefits that this type of crowdsourced work brings to workers. One of them that's been mentioned is freedom. For my workers, you know, for the 4 billion people who live on less than $3 a day, this is market access. This is access to jobs that they have never been able to compete for before. And when we talk about government intervention, one of the reasons that a lot of the people I work with don't have a job is that the U.S. government has these huge agricultural subsidies that make it not profitable for African farmers, who should be the people who are making our food. You know, it puts them out of work. And so this is incredibly exciting, I think, globally in terms of really leveling the playing field and allowing people who've never had a chance to compete before to get in and be able to offer their skills to the world. I also think what's exciting about this sector is that people who've been completely marginalized can now take part in what I've been calling a virtual assembly line. You know, I think in the last century, the big work innovation was taking the building of complex machines like cars out of the craftsman studio and into the factory, where people could be trained to do certain tasks, and it really broadened the playing field for work. And I think we're seeing a similar thing in digital work. The other side of that coin is that a lot of the work, because it's task-based and not people-based, doesn't include a lot of margin for things like benefits or even infrastructure costs. We're seeing that a lot of the paid crowdsourcing work, especially on platforms like Mechanical Turk, is really not paying enough to be able to cover a lot of the normal things that you'd cover in an employee-employer relationship. And so I think that means that we need to think about some of this work as piecemeal and maybe as a supplement to other things that people might do. And workers need to be able to have the freedom to make that trade-off. You know, do I want to exchange, you know, a little bit of my wage to have this freedom to work whenever I want from wherever I want?
Lily, I mean, it seems like you know, what Leila is saying is that this work can be incredibly empowering in one part of the world, and then back here, if it's sort of, you know, the job of last resort, it you know, doesn't offer much in the way of really a safety net.
Yeah, I mean, I think the key thing is to actually look at the conditions in which people are working. I think that you'll find in some places they will be working under pretty good conditions. Maybe there's an organization like SamaSource that makes sure to get money from funders to provide infrastructure, but if places do emerge or it becomes profitable to, say, run a sweatshop for Mechanical Turk work or other kinds of work, then judicious application of the law in the past has intervened in those kinds of situations. For example, in the clothing industry, it's actually illegal to have a piece rate for work. Basically, the scheme that Mechanical Turk uses, task pricing, is illegal in the clothing industry. You actually have to pay at least minimum wage, and if the piece rate exceeds minimum wage, then you can give the worker more based on their actual productivity. That doesn't apply to all industries. It applies to clothing specifically because the way the clothing industry worked out historically, they had a lot of sweatshops, and it was concretely putting a lot of people in a bad work, in a bad and unsafe work situation. So I'm advocating for actually investigating the conditions under which that's happening and applying law where you find workers don't, say, have the ability to collectively bargain against an employer, or where you do see people being worked for some, you know, reason, like 80 hours a week and getting repetitive stress injury. If we need to be vigilant and make sure those situations don't emerge and intervene if necessary.
Okay, I'm sure we will be returning to this topic before the discussion is over. But I'm very interested in whether crowdsourcing is anywhere near like really changing a particular industry, maybe disintermediating, you know, a certain kind of worker. So Jason Aiken, let me ask you, in just the design world, you know, with the success of 99 Designs, what's it done to the business?
Well, I mean, there's definitely a tension, for sure. I think, you know, at the end of the day, the internet has done a lot of things. It's created a lot of opportunity. It's leveled a lot of playing fields. You know, and it's really expanded the market for graphic design. And we don't think that 99 Designs really takes away anything from, say, a larger design agency, because that's typically not the kind of work that people are doing there. You know, it's more, you know, small projects for the most part at this stage, although we're starting to see, you know, you're connecting designer and client, right? So you're starting to see clients come in who maybe they have a new startup and they're offering, all right, you know, we really want to find our designer. It's not just about this one task. It's about building that relationship over the long term. And so, you know, we're offering, you know, this prize to design our interface or whatever for our web app. And, you know, catch our eye, do something exciting, and then we'll talk about bringing you on full time and giving you equity. You know, so there's a lot of opportunities that are attractive to people all over the world. I mean, is it pushing down price? Maybe. I mean, to some degree, I would say that it's more broadening the market and expanding, you know, that low end and exposing those people who would never have gotten professional graphic design to a more professional graphic design at an earlier stage. So people who would have gotten some sort of clip art, now they're seeing, oh, well, wow, I can get something that's this much more professional, and I start thinking about what that branding means for my business and what value it has, and then maybe, you know, as my business grows and gets more successful, I'll ratchet it up the chain a bit, and, you know, I realize, oh, well, I'm trying to do something a little bit more, you know, psychologically based. I'm looking for a different level of designer, so maybe I need to go someplace else or whatever the case may be. But I think there's a lot of opportunity.
Lucas Bewald, you see a lot of different kinds of crowdsource work at Crowdflower. I'm curious, what are the jobs that you think might just be totally transformed by this new kind of work? Are there occupations? I'll just say frankly, is my job getting crowdsourced?
Well, it probably will, right?
I think
it's really important. I mean, we keep talking about the effect on labor, which I think is, the jury's still really out. And I think it'll change lots of jobs. It'll change the way work works. But I think the thing that we really can be sure of, and that the good thing that will definitely come out of this, is increased efficiency everywhere. And increased efficiency is good for everyone on the whole. It might not be distributed equally, but it definitely is good for everyone. And I want to give like a really tangible example of this increased efficiency in the earthquake that recently happened in Haiti. And so a few days after the earthquake, it turned out that many of the buildings fell down, but the cell phone infrastructure was still intact. And so a really awesome organization called Frontline SMS set up a service where you could text a short code and you could say, hey, I'm trapped here, I need water. Or, hey, there's dead bodies here that need to be cleaned out. And they could say where they were located. So you had tens of thousands of people in Haiti texting the emergency situation they were in. And they sent these tasks to Crowdflower, and they got sent out to volunteers in the Haitian diaspora that would translate the message and write down where the longitude and latitude was. And this is actually kind of a difficult thing to do because in 160 characters, it's hard to exactly say where an address is. You need someone that knows the location. And so, first of all, aid organizations were now able to, within 10 minutes, get an accurate idea of where is their problem and where should I go to fix this. And so we, with help of lots of organizations, we would route it to places like the U.S. Coast Guard or the Red Cross that would send the right person to fix the problem. And then we actually did this amazing thing with Samasource, who had set up a data center in Haiti. And so now we send those tasks to people in a data center in rural Haiti, and they get jobs, and they learn in this sort of emergency situation how to do certain types of tech jobs, and over time they're going to start doing lots and lots of other Crowdflower jobs, right? So you get this nice effect with the workers, but the really visceral, tangible thing here is that there's a whole new way to do disaster relief, right? I mean, you could never plan infrastructure like this in advance, right? Suddenly, you need thousands of volunteers 24 hours a day to answer these messages and categorize these messages, and then you actually need them to go away over a few months as the number of messages die down. And so I think it's really important to remember that the effect on labor is really important, but increased efficiency is really good for the whole world.
Patrick, a lot of companies went looking for increased efficiencies during the downturn. Do you guys, and Patrick, I'll ask you, do you think the recession contributed, added fuel to this movement as companies look to maybe cut costs and crowdsource some of the work?
There's definitely just, over the last 6 years, there's been kind of an opening of mind by corporate America. In 2002, when we were first knocking on doors saying, we're going to have people working at home, we went to our first trade show. We actually set up a mock-up of a home. They get a little desk and a computer, and we set two of them up in different parts of the trade show, and we would show people, here, this is somebody's home, and look how the computer, just to get in their mind, this is what somebody's doing for you. And in a relatively short amount of time, 6 years, that stuff was put in the warehouse probably 4 years ago, but it was very useful. At this point, there's enough awareness around it that people are getting more comfortable with it. There are more references. JetBlue is well known for having home agents doing their reservations. Credit card companies, I won't name the specifics of them, are starting to do it, and so it's becoming more legitimate. And then with the downturn, plus the lashback of moving work offshore, we're talking about a lot of offshore things, but it's happening in the U.S. and the U.K. and in Europe in general. Consumers don't like talking to an offshore agent, and so when Dell gets on the hot seat for having outsourced to some country, they can look to a home agent model, still lower cost, which is really what Lucas is talking about. You get the productivity lift, and then they can have a better customer experience. So I think it's really a coming together of a lot of trends, market acceptance, cost requirement, and then the consumers are actually demanding more of this type of service.
Well, we're going to begin answering questions in a few minutes, so please start lining up at the microphones on either end of the room. But I just wanted to follow up. You mentioned that there's a little bit of a stigma around outsourcing and the idea of sending jobs overseas. Have you guys noticed anything of a stigma towards crowdsourcing? I mean, Patrick, you just declined to name a client. Do big companies not want to be associated with this?
The big projects that we've done, I think, like I said, we're mainly targeted at small businesses. But we've done projects for TiVo, Dish Networks, Adidas, things like that. And I think, for the most part with them, it's more about a PR opportunity and engaging their own communities and allowing their communities to take part in the creation of their brand or something that they're doing. I don't know. I think there's always going to be a little bit of sensitivity because you don't want to get somebody saying, hey, you're lowering wages or chipping our jobs. We're in need. Nobody wants that kind of attention. But, I think for the most part, the bigger companies for us who have used us, it's more a PR community engagement kind of a move.
Lucas, do you have clients whose name they would rather not be mentioned?
Yeah, so many of our clients don't want to have us talk about them. But I think for us it's more... Honestly, I think it's more of them considering working with us a competitive advantage that they don't want to share with the competition.
Lily, do these companies have good reason to be sensitive?
I think like Lucas said, the jury's out. All I know is that in the U.S., the surveys that we've been doing at UCRI, 15% of people do rely on Mechanical Turk to actually make their ends meet, and the number in India is about 30%. I have not heard of any sort of work-related disasters. I mean, at the end of the day, a worker has 50 employers, and if two of them are sketchy, then they are out to maybe $10 or something out of the $100 they would have made. So the crime against their wages is not of such great magnitude. What a lot of workers get mad about is the feeling of not that they don't have recourse, and the feeling that not giving them their wages is perfectly fine, and that there's not anyone there to really stand up for them in the institutions of crowdsourcing. So I think right now it's more of an issue of how we're making sure that it doesn't develop into something really unjust. And right now we have some sort of canary hints that things could build up that way.
Leela, I imagine in some of the communities in the developing world that you guys have enlisted there, you tell me, is there a sense of pride about this work?
Absolutely. It's so funny because the things I see in the field are so different from, the issues here. I just got back from India yesterday working with some Tibetan refugees who are living in Dharamshala. And I asked them, why are you guys interested in computers? Like, there's other stuff that you could do around here. You guys could be tour guides or maybe farmers. And they were just like, well, this is the future. Computers are the only way we're ever going to be able to join this new world economy, and we feel like we're being left out. And we know that you guys are in the States are using computers, and what's going to happen to us if we all become farmers? And I think there's some really interesting points there. The other thing that was said by a lot of the workers, particularly the refugee populations, is that getting into a computer lab to do work gives them some free time on the computers that they can use to connect with people that they've been disconnected with for, you know, in some cases more than a decade. So it's incredibly important to populations that are marginalized to feel connected to the rest of the world, and that's what a lot of this work does. I'll also say, you know, to the stigma issue, I think that the main issue that we're seeing in crowdsourcing is the same thing we saw about outsourcing 10 years ago. People have the sense here that we're losing jobs, that we're shifting jobs to overseas workers. And I think what America is waking up to is that we live in a global world and a global economy, and supply chains are global. And if we can buy stuff that was made in China for really cheap, then I think it's fair that we should expect that those workers who can work for really cheap are competing with us for jobs. And that's a realization that we're starting, you know, people are just starting to get comfortable with.
Great. We are going to crowdsource some questions now. As a reminder to our audience, this is the Commonwealth Club's InForum program, and tonight we're discussing crowdsourcing. I'm Brad Stone, technology reporter for the New York Times, and I'm here with Lucas Biewald, the founder of Crowdflower, Leela Jana, the founder of SamaSource, Jason Aiken, business development and marketing manager at 99designs, Lily Irani, a PhD candidate at UC Irvine, and Patrick McKenna, the founder of LiveOps. We have a question over here.
Yes, I have a question for Lily Irani about the project TurkOpticon. Mm-hmm. How do you handle, if I understand correctly, that is a online ranking for employers?
Yeah, it's a review site for employers, kind of like Yelp for employers, if people know what Yelp, the restaurant review site, is.
Do you have a problem, or how do you handle anonymous sabotage comments?
So are you referring to employers coming in and giving themselves good reviews?
Yes, that or the opposite. Thank you.
We haven't received any reports of employers angry because they feel that a review that's been placed on the site is unfair to them. So on the website, we do have a mechanism where people can respond to the reviews that have been written. And sometimes employers use that to clarify, you know, the circumstances around a bad review. And sometimes workers use that to say that this, you know, really, really positive review in a sea of negative reviews for this employer actually looks fishy. We've seen more examples, actually, of employers coming in and trying to give themselves positive reviews to diffuse bad reputation acquired among workers writing about their experiences on the site.
So this is directed at Jason. I am curious to what degree you guys require your workers to show proof that they've actually purchased the design software that they're using?
We have 0 degree of showing any proof that they've purchased any design software. And we don't know what sort of programs they're using. They could be using Photoshop. They could have, you know, downloaded it and cracked it. They could have gotten it legally. They could be using GIMP. We don't know. We don't require any sort of proof.
Well, I mean, do you see that as a problem? I mean, overall, you know, the issue is, you know, you're talking about workers that, you know, and by and large can go down to a local bazaar and, you know, buy Photoshop for $10 or the equivalent thereof, you know, that possibly have the state pay for their education, pay for their health care. You know, all of these costs that, you know, somebody, a designer in the States, is going to have to shoulder. Right. And
but, I mean, is there any guarantee that a designer in the States bought their copy of Photoshop?
No, for sure not, but there's a lot more strict, there's a lot stricter laws here
enforce yeah,
it.
I mean, I hear you, but at the same time, I mean, we're just creating a marketplace, so, I mean, let's say
but, I mean, you are driving the cost of design
down. What's the solution? I mean, how can Jason, I mean, it's a good question, but how could he possibly guarantee, you know, what's sitting on the PC of someone across the world?
I'm sure that there's software that can be used to remotely check that kind of stuff.
Sounds knows everything.
Well, that's a good question, though. Thanks.
Hi there. I have a general question. You've spoken a lot about parsing out digital tasks. Can you speak to some examples that are a little bit more global in nature that parse out knowledge to really big issues or situations like solving, you know, medical issues and things like that. Could be global warming or just big picture things.
Like, can we crowdsource the answers to the big questions? It's a little bit like Yahoo Answers or those kinds of services on a smaller scale.
Sure. Or even the X Prize, I think.
I mean DARPA like has a trend of doing lots of really interesting prizes. I mean, DARPA actually did a great crowdsourcing prize recently where they released a bunch of balloons around the country, and I think it took like 6 hours for someone to find the locations of all the balloons. I thought it was going to take weeks for someone to figure that out, but so many people have cameras and people are so connected that it was really fast to find all the balloons launched.
I think one of the most powerful examples is an organization called Innocentive, which I think came out of a pharma company, and they were facing this problem that, you know, all of their R&D is in-house, and there are a lot of problems that they can harness the world's talent to solve. So they basically post big biomedical challenges, and I think now Innocentive is used for a lot of different types of issues, and then they get the crowd to respond with solutions.
At the same time, as you get into more difficult questions, don't the quality control issues just get really, really tough?
I think if you design the specs well enough, as Innocentive has really pioneered, and XPRIZE as well, then you can get good results.
I mean, look at Netflix, right? They got the best researchers in the world working for them for the Netflix prize.
Question over here.
I'd like to actually return to the question that Brad posed about journalism. And, you know, with half the daily newspapers in this country probably going out of business in the next 5 to 7 years, do you have any suggestions on whether there are any kind of applications of crowdsourcing for the media ecosystem? Possibly not replacing Brad. I kind of think that journalists are pretty highly skilled folks that, you know, you really can't outsource to India. But are there elements like, you know, customer support or website support or that sort of thing that can sort of cut costs and help these publications stay in business?
Fact-checking?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, our readers do that for us, and I guess that is a
already happening.
No, it's a good question. I mean, you know, one issue is that newspapers and magazines are highly unionized organizations and would probably resist, you know, moving some of the secondary kind of jobs into a crowdsourced environment. But, you know, in terms of the journalism, I mean, what is the blogosphere if not a big, you know, crowdsourced newspaper constantly updated?
Well, it's a big commentary forum for commenting on the stuff that you're writing. It's not doing a lot of original reporting.
Well, thank you for saying that.
Okay.
Over here.
Yeah, hi. Jason, you made me think of something. When you have a body of 60,000 designers, and this actually applies to everybody, do you see sort of the 80-20 rule where a very, very small number of people take most of the jobs? Or when you put any one job out to the crowd, does a very small group take them all?
Yeah, there's definitely designers who are more successful than others, for sure. And I mean, part of that comes down to experience. Part of it comes down to just innate talent. Part of it comes down to experience working in that environment and learning how to sell your value, you know, remotely. A lot of times people, you know, graphic designers who have a problem with the way that we do business or the market that we create, you know, they'll say, oh, well, you're taking the relationship out. And that's definitely not true. And I think the most successful designers, you know, really work to preserving that and building that relationship into that process and communicating through feedback and so forth.
Great. We only have about 10 minutes remaining, so I want to get to as many questions as possible.
Sure. My question is, how do you see the impact of crowdsourcing on enabling entrepreneurship and startups? For example, in the last 6 months, I've been working on a website, and I have no talents besides some pocket money. And I've been able to get a design and some coders and pretty much the whole thing built with only my input. And I was wondering how you see that changing the face of the kind of people that start projects, start startups, or entrepreneurship over the next 5-10 years.
Patrick?
So since leaving LiveOps, I've started a new company. And similar situation, my talent is not coding, so I have to find lots of help. And I've managed to start a company for... so it was my third company. The first one, we raised $60 million and probably cost $4 million in infrastructure. And the second one, we, you know, raised, you know, I don't know, $15, $20 million, and it cost a couple million dollars in infrastructure. And today, you can start a company. You can outsource everything.
you can outsource your co-location. You go to Odesk and get developers. You can go to Elance and get web designers. You can go to 99 Design and get your logo done. You can go and you can outsource your back office. Actually, I'm just giving you the recipe for what I did. I've done every single one of these steps. And this kind of gets back to an answer of the earlier question. I'm an entrepreneur, and I'm much like the journalist or whoever is in the knowledge business. I want to focus on the problem. If I spend all my time doing QuickBooks rather than having my India outsourcer doing QuickBooks, or if I spent all these hours working with my logo designer or recruiting engineers constantly, which is an important task depending on your type of company, I wouldn't be able to focus on the problem. So I think that if you use outsourcing in this type of way and you know what you're good at, then I think you can move very fast for very efficient capital. When you get to a certain point, then you can make other investment decisions. So I think this outsourcing in general is opening up a lot of entrepreneurism. I'm very excited about that.
Question over here.
Yeah, this is a question for the folks who are operating crowdsourcing platforms. You mentioned that we're living in a 21st century workforce with 20th century labor laws, and I think the same would apply to the property scheme as well. But I would invite the people here to read some of the participation agreements that govern these crowdsourcing platforms, which in fact rely heavily on 20th century property and labor laws. Given the premise that this industry would not exist without people like you who have built these platforms and operate them, I wonder what kind of role you feel that you have in ensuring the property and employment rights of the people who are participating in your venues. Rather than leaving it to this sort of pretending as if you're a marketplace, a venue for independent parties to come together, what sort of responsibility do you feel that you have?
Lucas, you want to take a crack at that?
Patrick, it's a really difficult question that we think about a lot, but don't have a lot of good answers for. I mean, there's things like who owns the intellectual property, right? And of course, our customers want to own all the work that's produced by the people doing this. But that's actually pretty similar to if you hired a contractor to work for you. And I mean, I think it's important to remember that these platforms, all of these platforms, actually are incredibly transparent, right? And actually, that's different than a lot of kind of work you might do. It's different than a lot of sweatshops, right? I mean, you actually can watch your bank account go up minute by minute, right? I mean, in a lot of these situations. And I just want to add, I didn't get to mention this, but I think one of the weirdest things that's coming in terms of legal issues is that we actually pay about half our workers in virtual currency. In some type of virtual currency. So this might be like Second Life money, or it might be like Farmville money. And that's pretty weird, right? I mean, like, do you tax that? I mean, if you're going to tax people doing productive work in Farmville, doing like productive business work in Farmville, are you going to tax the guy that's growing plants in Farmville and selling the seeds, right? Because now suddenly if you think there's like real economic value to this currency, there's real economic value to the gold
farmers. And you do
farmers.
This because in this case, the company that makes Farmville is the client of the work.
We actually buy virtual money. I mean, we're big buyers of virtual money. So we'll buy Farmville money and like Yeovil cash and all these games that I don't play very many of them. But they're great. I mean, they have great business models. I mean, Zynga made what $500 million in revenue because they're printing money, right? I mean, literally, they are printing fake money. So we actually we trade real money for their fake money so that we can pay the workers. But people put real value on this.
Okay. Can I make one more point? There actually is an important part of there's intellectual capital that the workers getting in this type of market that we haven't really talked about, and that is their reputation. So within the marketplace, an individual worker has a reputation, and 80-20 applies everywhere. I mean, you have a group of with designers or call center reps or the refugee workers. There's a group of workers who are superior at that particular task than others. And that reputation within the marketplace is transferable. So they don't have to go when they walk into a new job and say, you've never met me before. Within the marketplace, they use that reputation to command the next better job. And in live ops, there's a lot of
the early, you know, there's stuff that you make $5 an hour and there's stuff you make $20 an hour. And as people move their reputation, they actually can bid for more work at higher value. So I think that that is something we haven't talked about, the intellectual the capital of the individual worker is moving that around the marketplace. I think there is a lot of value there.
Okay, I think we only have time for one more question, so we have to make it a quick one.
Hi. My question is about teamwork. Certainly Wikipedia shows that you can have a lot of online collaboration and teamwork across the board, but it seems like when you get into the economics of the situation that it's usually one person winning in the end, that it's an individual who's receiving the phone call, who gets the bid for the design, who answers the question. And I'm wondering how you feel teamwork and collaboration fit into economic business models of crowdsourcing.
That's a great question. How do you compensate teamwork?
So it's interesting because all of our workers actually work in teams. None of them work individually. And I think there are strong benefits, strong sort of psychological benefits to working with other people, at least for part of your life. And we also have found that the workers tend to train each other and get better much faster when they're working in one center together. So we have all of our workers, you know, working at these distributed partner locations around the world, and they also collaborate together on Basecamp, this online project management tool, and share tips and tricks for optimizing their performance on platforms like Crowdflower. So they work together both physically and virtually, and that's actually a really important aspect of the work we do and the value that we bring to our customers.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
Great, thank you for the question. Well, these in-forum sessions have usually end with a lightning round, with a single question. How would you change the world? I assume we mean, how would you make the world a better place? So I want to pose that tough one to our panelists for quick answers. Lucas, you're on the hot seat.
Oh, man. So, I mean, we want to increase the GDP of the world by efficiently routing work everywhere. That's what we try to do.
Lila?
We want to make sure that everyone on the planet has access to dignified work.
Jason.
Yeah, absolutely. We're spreading opportunity. I mean, I think that's the key message as far as we're concerned.
Well, Lily.
For me, it would be making sure that workers have a way to actually hold employers accountable for their fair wages.
And Patrick, you have the last word.
I'll be very practical. I really think that it's important that every single person has access to high-speed internet. It is the economic rationale for high-speed internet being invested across the U.S., North America, the world. It's the work problem, not the media problem.
Great. Well, let's give a big hand to the panelists. Now this meeting of Inforum and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.